listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, our weekly conversation with geostrategic analyst and senior lecturer from Moscow State University, Mark Sloboda, for a view from Moscow of this past week's midterm elections and the apparent admission by the U.S. Secretary of State of the intent of the U.S. to commit a crime against humanity by starving the people of Iran.
Hi, Don. Thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on CPR.
All our pleasure.
Why don't we start with a postmortem from the U.S. midterms,
yeah.
At least. As seen from the outside.
Yeah, for sure. How does it look from Moscow? Because it looks pretty crazy, right?
Yeah, it looks pretty... First of all, it has to be said that the structure for U.S. elections is awful. And we've heard that, you know, in comparison to multiple countries at this point, between voters... Being purged partisanly from voter rolls, third parties being sued to be kept off the ballot, polling stations closed, long waiting lines, problems with machines, incompatibility from state to state. This 50 states holding different elections, all using different machinery, all under different conditions. The process of the elections themselves looks like a mess.
Yeah, it sure does.
And people would not believe that in Russia, all elections here are fake, according to, the dominant meme about things are done in Russia.
Yeah, well, an election in Russia, you have a piece of paper with one box in it. You have to check it, and there's a guy with a gun that follows you into the booth, right?
Yeah, well, Two guys with guns, just in case the
one
first
misses,
one
right.
backs down, right? Just in case the first one is unreliable.
Gotcha.
With all the questions about previous, Russian elections in the last 10 years, the Russian government has really gone to great measures, clear voting boxes, video cameras that anyone can access online that cover every voting station in the country. No black box voting for one thing. It's all done with paper and right. Which is I would have to say it prevents the raising of questions with black box voting and other things like that. Yep. But also, no, especially no waiting lines, no broken machines, no stations closed.
Right.
Everyone in the country, can easily vote with their place of residence.
Right.
I've voted here. Just for the first time last year, but I've been to voting stations. I've been an observer at voting stations here before. Really is much better organized. There's much more personnel involved. It's usually done at local schools, and most of the people conducting the elections are school teachers, right? Those infamously Putin, Putin cronies, these school marms and everything. It's a shame, from the news that we see, about, huge lines and people, not going to vote. And I know from personal experience the mess it is for expats to vote who are out of the country. And in most cases, their votes aren't even counted then.
Right.
Unless, it could really statistically, change the effect. It's almost never done.
Right.
In Russia, like many other countries, if you're overseas, you simply go into your embassy or consulate and vote, and that's it. And it's not this back and forth registering and voting by mail, and it's a mess. The whole system is a mess, and a lot of it is, and also the day, that it is conducted during a work day. During the workday, it's not conducted on the holiday on the weekend. It's not a holiday. It's there's no federal rules about allowing people to go to vote. It's a mess, and it's done, of course, in order to reduce the number of people who vote,
and that works because less than half do.
Yeah. So that said, we did have pretty good turnout. For this election.
Yes.
Particularly among for a midterm election, particularly among youth, minorities, women, there was pretty good turnout. So it's higher than in previous years. The final tally isn't in yet that I've heard as of speaking, but it is definitely over the recent years of 39-40% for midterm elections.
NPR said it hit a 50-year high at more than 47%.
47%. Okay. So almost half of eligible voters. Right.
Yikes.
Yeah, well, it's better than 40% of eligible
voters. That's correct.
Voters,
that's true. Yeah.
So, considering that 2014 was one of the lowest years for midterm elections in recent memory, so I saw that a huge number of voters, over two-thirds, turned out either way with a strong opinion about Trump being their primary. So in many ways, it was a referendum on Trump. I think that is a fair characterization.
Yep.
Of this election, and people were voting, down ballot party line, pretty preferably. So that reduces the it increases the parliamentary party effect,
right?
That they see in parliamentary systems, rather than the ability to vote for a you know, an individual candidate, which I thought was has always been one of the strengths of the U.S. elections.
Or a policy, since the parties, in essence, have abandoned policy as a platform. Yeah,
I think more policy almost gets done via referendums, and there were a few.
That's right.
You know, significant referendums, you know, on different state ballots. And that's something to be said, at least, I guess. You know, as for the results of the election, you know, it again, Trump, you know, the Republicans gained slightly in the Senate and lost significantly, but actually in line with a standard midterm. I mean, it's a truism of American politics that the sitting president's party, you know, usually does poorly during midterm elections. It's the U.S. Citizenry need to balance powers, if you will, or just a simple counter reaction with turnout. There was no huge blue wave that I saw. There was no Trump's approval rating is hanging around 40%, little plus, you know, a little minus. Right. But, you know, with the archaic U.S. voting system, you know, gerrymandering that you really saw in effect in this election and so on. And, you know, the simple rules for the Senate and populations and everything. We see that, you know, geography gains a certain advantage and rural states, which, you know, tend to generally be Republican, you know, outweigh their more populous urban counterpoints. And we saw, I think it was up to 7 million more votes nationally, of course, went for Democrats in the Senate, but the Republicans won the Senate race.
Right.
And that's simply a result of the U.S., archaic voting system. So,
right.
You know. The Republicans, you know, took advantage of it. That's why Trump won the election, you know, again, because of this geography over sheer population. Some people's votes count more than others in the United States, sometimes many more. And that, you know, that's simply the way it works. And, you know, you have to plan your electoral strategy accordingly. So, you know, there was a few significant, we saw Mitt Romney, the former Republican governor of Massachusetts, don't ask me how that ever happened, become a senator.
From Utah.
Cruz, yeah, of Utah, and a Mormon carpetbagger.
Right.
Ted Cruz nearly held on to his seat. We saw
he owes that to Trump, by the way, which is an interesting little dynamic. After all of the theatrics at the RNC, he'd be out of a job without Trump.
Yeah. Either way, he swung around and showed that, you know, that party over principle or something like that, I guess. We saw the long expected election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez as a supposedly young minority left wing congresswoman. How exactly left wing she is, particularly when it comes to foreign policy, remains to be seen. And we can expect challenges, of course, for Nancy Pelosi's leadership. I would hope there's at least a challenge, to centrist business as usual as the Democrats take over, but and fights for various committees. What's awaiting the Trump administration with Democratic control of the House? Nothing good.
Good. I agree with that.
First of all, their legislative agenda, such as it is, I'm not sure that Trump really had a legislative agenda that I could identify. And Paul Ryan, you know, stood down himself, which is almost unheard of, particularly for someone that young and so on. And I think primarily it's to disassociate himself with Trump, but I could be wrong with that.
Yeah.
The legislative agenda, Republic is dead. So I sum it up, you know, three ways. Gerrymandering plus geographic polarization equals gridlock. three G's right there. And that sums up the, you know, the election. And so gridlock. I mean, that's nothing new. Both Obama and Clinton had hostile Congresses for most of their presidencies. So that, you know, that's actually the standard order of business in Washington. So nothing. Right. You know, the one thing that seems to generally get, cross bipartisan support is, you know, imperialist foreign policy and military
right.
spending.
Yeah, no kidding.
So those are the two things that only really tend to get done during this type of hostile Congress.
And so far, that's true. That's what happened. I mean, when even with Republican majorities, when they did the military budget the first year, Trump said, here, let's have this increase. The Republicans said, yeah, we'll do that. The Democrats said, no, have that increase plus this. And
yeah.
They actually threw more money on top
right,
of
yeah.
it.
We'll double down on that.
Right, know? Yeah.
We're more the party of war than you are. There seems to be a competition these days.
Yeah.
I'm not sure when it was that the Democrats became the party of war. I guess it started during the Clinton administration yeah. and escalated from there.
Yeah,
certainly during the Obama administration. But you know how much I see. Democratic. You saw it with Hillary Clinton's campaign when Robert Kagan and the neocons came to support her. But you know you see it all over the place now. I see figures, you know, Thomas Friedman talking about, oh, how, you know, despite having supported the Iraq war, you know, these neocons are actually pretty good people. I'm like,
yeah, right.
No. Yeah. Well, that's a condemnation of you more than anything
right,
else.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, two parties of war and you know, for the two parties of power.
Let me ask you on that, because while you were on the neocons, this is something that I did a couple of interviews myself the last couple of days, and this is something that hangs in front of me. You know, you've got Trump saying, he hasn't been able to actualize it, who knows what the reasons are for that, whether it's his own lack of motivation or being constrained by events in politics here. But he wanted to reverse the neocon direction, you know, the regime change thing and all that was bad. And he wanted to, you know, get a better set of relations with Russia and China. And, you know, we see resistance in the form of he has the Helsinki summit with Putin and they want to put him in not just in prison, but execute him for treason over this. He gets accused of being a traitor and everything else. Whatever he might have planned to do after the midterms were settled. With the Democrats in control of the House, they are in control of impeachment, if they'd like. Nancy Pelosi said, well, we won't impeach unless the Republicans want it, but it's not hard for me to envision a Republican holding a press conference and then Nancy Pelosi having a ham sandwich impeachment vote 10 minutes later, and now he's impeached. It goes to the Senate. Well, right now, they're going to have Republicans somewhere between 51 and 54 members, depending on how some of those races shake out. So yeah. The Democrats have 40-something plus two. The two independents will vote with them. And that's not enough for the two-thirds necessary to remove him from office. But nested within the 51 to 54 Republicans are many, many, many neocons. Trump decides to make a play for any or all of these things, a peace treaty with Korea, maybe even with Iran, new business with Russia and China, do the neocons and the Democrats remove them?
Yeah, I mentioned the exact same thing on Crosstalk on Sunday.
Great minds.
This potential. Yeah. I mean, it's true with the split House and the, you know, Republicans controlling the Senate that nominally, you know, the Democrats can't impeach Trump. I mean, we have to remember that impeachment is a political process,
right,
not a legal process.
Right.
But this is a neocon gun to us. I mean, the neocons already have control of
right.
the administration's foreign and military policy, Bolton, Pompeo,
right.
you know, and others. I've even heard rumors that Mattis is considered too mad dog, the mad dog, the guy who said that, you know, be polite, be professional, but have a plan to kill every single person you meet, and that it was fun killing Afghans, you know, during the 17 long U.S.
Wow.
war there, the longest war in U.S. history. But he may be too restrained, too
right.
peaceful for them. So they're talking, at least talking about getting rid of him for someone more, you know,
More mad.
You know, despite Trump's rhetoric during the campaign, ironically, we heard the same thing in the first campaign from Obama. We heard the same thing from George W. Bush during his campaign about a more restrained, inwardly focused foreign policy. We heard that again and again. And we heard it with Trump, strongest, actually speaking out against regime change and U.S. Mess with Syria, supporting jihadis and everything. And how awful and what a waste of it. And the exact opposite is turned about right now. Unlike Obama, we have extremely, moving towards conflict with Iran. You know, that is, you know, I believe that is on the table for the next, 2 years. They're definitely making a push towards conflict with Iran. Tensions with Russia are actually worse than during the Obama administration, despite his campaign rhetoric. You know, how much he's responsible for that and, you know, how much has been forced on him, you know, politically, you know, by the neocons, so a deep state. You know, I don't know. Maybe he simply became, you know, doesn't have a strong real view about this and became convinced the other
whatever
way.
It is, that equation just changed for the worse, though, right?
Be it sanctions, pulling out of treaties and everything else, there's no question that the Trump administration has done far more against Russia than the Obama administration did. The idea of improving, you know, relations with Russia is completely gone at this point. And we actually have increased tensions with China because of a tariff war and, you know, sanctions on allies and everything. You know, it's generally, I mean, we're not yet at war in a new country. We're not bombing a country that we weren't any more countries than we were at the end of Obama's administration yet. You know, knock on wood there. The new U.S. policy in Syria is that we are permanently militarily occupying the country until we get the change of government we want by economic and political blackmail now instead of overt regime change. The Syrians aren't allowed to ally with the Iranians and aren't allowed to have any Iranians in their country. That's the other the other caveat there. And, it seems like in many ways, U.S. participation in, you know, the Saudis' genocidal war on Yemen has increased. And the whole Khashoggi affair has demonstrated what is the life of one Saudi journalist / former intelligence asset, you know, compared to the cost of human lives in Yemen, which is, actually better estimated. I've seen it, at a couple hundred thousand. We're looking at now when you count in the deliberate starvation deaths and so on.
I remember reporting back in like 2016, 2015 that there were something like 9 million people that were, you know, days away from starvation. And so I don't know how many people have fallen off since then, but it's a lot more than they've been reporting here, I'm sure.
And the Saudi Arabia is really deliberately depressing the numbers and making sure that reports don't get done at the UN using the heft of their money there, their money and influence as they are in Washington, of course. Foreign policy wise, things look bad. And, you know, the Trump administration is with the Democratic control of the House is facing not just the potential, at least for impeachment, whether it becomes a reality with neocon defection if he tries something foreign policy wise, or simply political theater before the next election if it's decided they need to bring that up again. And even if they don't have a chance to pass it, they could bring it up simply to create outrage, generate more hysteria about him. It's kind of cynical, but these things happen. Also, investigations. You will see House investigations yin-yang. You will see subpoenas. There will be a flood of subpoenas across Trump administration. They will try to put everyone under oath until they say something stupid. As we saw with Flynn and Papadopoulos, who didn't actually do anything except lie to the FBI.
Perjury and obstruction.
That weren't illegal. and it hit them with an obstruction of justice.
Or perjury.
I don't,
yep.
I, Yeah, I don't know if the Mueller investigation itself will go away. We don't see protests against wars in this country anymore, but we do see protests against continuing this. I'm sorry, it's a witch hunt, you know, with absolutely zero evidence of Trump-Russia collusion. But we got Manafort on back taxes, so you know, I guess, you know, that is supposed to be what the Mueller investigation was about, right? Back taxes on foreign, you know, profits, and it's
right. It's not a witch hunt, but we threw Flynn in the water and he floated, so we drowned him.
Yeah. So in new investigations, we'll see investigations into, you know, sexual allegations of harassment and misconduct. And God knows there's enough of those. I think there's some 19 at this point.
Right.
We'll see investigations of Trump's finances, demands for his taxes. We'll see investigations over giving his son-in-law Kushner a security clearance and a top advisory job, you know, ethics investigations. We'll see all kinds. So subpoenas, investigations, hearings, we'll be flooded. And then, you know, of course, you have the legislative agenda dead and the potential for at least the theater of impeachment, if not something more substantive.
Speaking of theater, there's going to be some entertainment value in the investigations, because now that he has secured, and with the Senate, he's going to secure the appointment of a new attorney general, the Department of Justice, you're going to start seeing the investigations go both ways. You know, the neat thing about Washington is, wherever you aim subpoenas, you're going to find criminal activity. And so, you know, I mean, if you put 100 senators on the stand, sooner or later, you're going to be able to perjury trap or obstruction of justice trap each one of them, because they're all up to something no good. And Trump is going to be able to do dueling investigations now, and that's going to be a lot of entertainment value.
Well, he could have before, but it wasn't done.
I think Sessions wouldn't do it. I think that was the real source of tension.
Was that the real? Yeah. Well, yeah, that's possible. I mean, they could have been launched from the House.
Yeah.
But Paul Ryan didn't, and I thought that was a mistake, a tactical mistake. Trump administration. You know, the things that Manafort came up. Well, you know, we saw enough with the Podesta brothers that they're doing the exact same sort of thing and so on. That wasn't done in the House, and now it becomes a lot harder, I think, actually, with you know, the Democrats certainly won't be launching any House investigations into their own members.
No, but DOJ can do it directly. That's
Department of Justice. Yeah, we'll see. You know, Trump will have to get a attorney general through Congress, and, you know, that won't be easy at this point.
He has the Senate, so I mean, it's an advise and consent position. I don't think he needs the House.
He doesn't need the House, but the political, impetus, you know, will be, very strong against anyone that would be seen as providing too much assistance to him.
That's true. So let's go to this thing with Iran and Pompeo.
Hold on. Yeah, let me just wrap up there. What I wanted to say is that what does Trump have left then? Right. Of course, he has the Senate, and judicial appointments. We'll see an acceleration of that probably, because that's done via the Senate.
Yeah.
So we'll see a lot of federal judicial appointments. We'll see focus on that. We'll see executive orders and an attempt to legislate via executive orders, which Obama did. And we'll see, I think, even more of that with Trump. Of course, he won't be writing it, but, you know, someone will be. The other thing is, you know, military and foreign policy, and actually foreign policy, you know, and the position of commander in chief are actually the primary powers of the presidency, not domestic politics. But we often see that it's only when presidents are denied advancing their domestic agenda with a split Congress, we see presidents then shift to become more focused on foreign policy, to be doing something. And I think that is what we'll see here. You see a little bit of both. Looking at it from, a Russian perspective, well, on one hand, it might be good if the U.S. is consumed with gridlock and get nothing done. has vitriol back and forth, between the two parties of power. On the other hand, presidents do tend to get more active overseas when they're denied their domestic agenda at home. So we don't. It could go either way. From that perspective, I mean, that's the perspective looking, from the outside. It's a mess, and the U.S. government is a mess, and the parties are a mess, and this political trials in Washington are a mess. Let's hope that they focus on the mess and not on foreign policy. That is an out that we could be provided. And we recently already saw Trump cancel an expected meeting on the side of Paris summit, coming up next week on the memorial of World War One, anniversary of World War One. So Trump already canceled a scheduled sidelines meeting with Putin there. So that that doesn't look good already. So Pompeo. Trump's new Secretary of State.
Yeah, we've got a minute, so
the CIA. Yeah, he said Iranian leaders will have to fall in line if they want their people to eat.
Wow.
Think about new U.S. sanctions on Iran, or rejuvenated sanctions on Iran. And I'm like, well, as awful as that sounds, at least he's actually admitting what every U.S. administration is trying to do with sanctions,
right?
Which is punish the people of a country enough that they then, create instability, and the hope that their governments either fall in line with U.S. policy or then toppled, and because of deprivation of the population, basically. And Pompeo is honest about that. So,
right.
Every time the U.S., someone in the U.S., including Pompeo, claims to speak in the interests of the Iranian people or the Russian people or the Chinese people or any people out there that the U.S. is sanctioning, remember this quote. If they want to eat, their leaders better do what the U.S. Tells them to do.
And what it reminds me, Madeleine Albright starving 500,000 Iraqi children was worth it. Yeah. Mark, thanks a lot.
Sanctions are bipartisan.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you very much, Mark. We'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is the idea of peace in Yemen antithetical? Also, Trump is insulted. The Europeans might defend themselves. And Russiagate front and center. Again. Cross-talking some real news. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Babich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Glenn Deason. He is a professor at the Higher School of Economics, as well as author of The Decay of Western Civilization and Resurgence of Russia. All right, as usual, gentlemen, cross-talk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Dima, let me go to you first here. Donald Trump went to Paris for the ceremonies commemorating the end of the First World War, the bringing of peace after that carnage of four years and 20 million dead and 20 million casualties. He felt insulted that his host, President Macron in France, proposed a real European army.
Very insulting. He wrote
very
on
insulting.
His Twitter.
Considering Trump's very dismissive attitude towards NATO in a number of ways. How do you respond to all of it?
Well, normally, logically, Russia should be insulted because actually Macron, here's what he said. Faced with Russia, which is at our borders and has shown that it can be a threat, we need a Europe which defends itself better without just depending on the United States in a more sovereign manner. End of quote.
So for a globalist, it's kind of interesting coming out of his mouth.
Who is threatened here? is he going to build a European army against the United States? No. against Russia. He says it quite openly. And I think it's a disgrace, 100 years after the war, in which France and Russia were on the same side, in which millions of Russians died. He says it, Russia, which is now at our borders. He forgets to mention why Russia is at the borders of the European Union. It's not because Russia expanded. It's because NATO and the European Union expanded, not paying any attention to any concerns that Russia might raise about it.
Yeah, but Dima, he didn't only mention Russia, did he?
Also,
he mentioned the United States.
China, he said Russia, China, and we all are fearing the imminent Chinese invasion of Europe on the other side of the world. I know I am, right? Chinese troops are about to disembark on, in Normandy, I'm pretty sure. But he also mentioned the United States. And even the United States, he said, talking about the need to defend against. Now, this talk is simply Macron trying to put on war hawk credentials. Come on. France can't even pay 2% of its GDP according to NATO strictures. And he's talking up a European Union
army. He's
talking
like the Sun King I think. Yeah. And I want to talk about also the reports that Macron did not want Putin and Trump to meet. Glenn, jump in.
Yeah, no, I was going to say this EU army is not a new idea, though.
Actually, here, I will show everyone here, the National Interest last week had an article, Washington smothers independent European security initiatives. The entire history of it since 1991.
Well, 6 months after the Soviet Union collapsed, they met in Germany for the Peterborough Task Force, which was to develop military capabilities for the European Union. Now, they were able to strike a compromise with the United States in which they would have a clear division of labor. Usually, NATO would do the interventions, the invasions, and the EU would do the dishes, essentially, at the end to do the peacekeeping or the training. So,
good cop, bad cop?
It would be the softer one. But
I would call it political fig leaf to the U.S. military.
Keep going, Glenn. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but what has happened now, of course, is there's been more push for an EU army because, Trump has alienated the Europeans. And we can't really forget that the British has been the main one to obstruct an EU army. And now with Brexit, they're pretty much out of the way. And for France, they've been pushing for or already developed a security initiative outside EU structures. And the Germans would like to bring it in. So you have all these different incentives for developing an EU army, but I think also an important point is that the EU is really struggling for its existence now. The reason why people join the EU is political and economic reasons.
Right.
And economically it's flopping, it's going from crisis to crisis. So I think there is a need now to essentially get a new purpose for the EU, and it looks like that's pivoting towards the military.
Is there any indication, Dima, that the Europeans want to have their own army?
It depends on which Europeans
you mean.
No,
I'm not talking about the elites. I'm talking about real people.
Normal Europeans, I think, see no threat from Russia. They're sick of the wars in the Middle East. They don't want Europe to support the insurgents in Syria. They don't want Europe to bomb Libya in order to kill Gaddafi and plunge the country into the civil war. But if we look at what has been going on since 1992, the European Union actually started more wars than the United States. I remember how the whole thing in Libya started. It was not the United States. It was Sarkozy and the French planes that bombed it first. How did the Yugoslav war begin? There was an article in Le Monde which said, some people think that the United States started all of this. No, Paris and London asked, they lobbied the United States to go together with them into Yugoslavia. In Kosovo, the United States was providing air support. The ground operation was conducted by European troops. If you look at the history of European Union, since 1992, they didn't make peace with anyone. The United States at least improved relations with Cuba somewhat. Now Trump is destroying even that. The EU only quarreled with Russia, with Yugoslavia, with Libya, with Syria, with Iran, with anyone who objects. So basically, and even that quote from Macron when he is saying that Europe needs to be kind of defensive against the United States.
Hold it right there, Dima. Is this some kind of gambit that Macron is playing right now? Because I don't see there's a lot of political will and certainly no political guts.
And there's certainly no funding for such a thing, right? This is largely a political move, and we could just dismiss this as Macron's version of fake news. In fact, I think a lot of this is simply a way of striking back against Trump's criticisms of and demanding that European countries spend more on their defense as part of NATO structures. Now, let's remember, all the European countries have their own national armies, right? Most of them, is insignificant, except, of course, for like France and the United Kingdom.
And Turkey.
And well, if you consider it, Turkey's not part of the EU, of course, but part of NATO, right? They all are also part of NATO structures, but they still can't, most of them, all but five of them, can't even spend 2% of their GDP on the military. In fact, this may actually be, the discussions of it may actually be a way to cut military spending, because France and the United Kingdom have previously, in the last few, before Brexit, of course, been involved in cooperation where they share military resources,
aircraft
carrier, right? Because they can't afford, this global type militaries, capable of power projection around the world. And, this is what the European Union, these countries like France are really concerned about. It's not defending their own countries. It's being able to project military power in Africa, in the Middle East, in Asia, right? We recently saw United Kingdom,
I
believe French troops involved in the South China Sea, all right, in these military parades that, the U.S. is putting on there, saber-rattling against China. So I don't think we should take Macron's talk of an EU army seriously. If anything, this is just a way for him to try to hit back against Trump.
But Glenn, let's say in an imaginary world, because NATO is certainly not going to go away anytime soon, but in an imaginary world here, if there is this growing rift between the EU and the United States, would European elites still consider Russia a threat? Because you'd have to go through a threat analysis here. And because a lot of it is driven by, Russia is a threat, it's driven by the United States. Macron can pick up on it. But I'm basically convinced that the Europeans would want to actually engage Russia in terms of security and not deeming it as an enemy.
I don't necessarily agree, because if you look at what the European Union's done in terms of economic terms, when they looked at how to engage with its neighbors, so the common neighborhood it has with Russia, it has always used a tool such as the Eastern Partnership, which excludes the Russians. When they now try to reach further into Eurasia, they won't even mention the Eurasian Economic Union. So this kind of this very zero-sum approach.
So the Europeans would like to take on the idea of being a military competitor to Russia? You're telling me that?
No, I'm saying that they have no interest in harmonizing their interests and integration efforts with Russia. I think.
I'm not saying that. But I don't. Saying is, that would they be deemed as the same kind of enemy? Okay, militarily.
Well, if you develop them as a military power, if that becomes the reason for the EU to exist, they can take on a very.
This is a defense of the European Union.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's not NATO that is expanding to the east, though, by hook or crook. We have to remember that the current crisis in Ukraine was precipitated not by NATO expansion yet, right? Not by a military move, but by the EU crafting a neoliberal shock therapy diktat of an EU association agreement. And when at the last minute the Ukrainian president Yanukovych backed down because he wasn't getting the billions in funding he expected to be able to finance these deep neoliberal shock therapy cuts and said, no, not now, not under these conditions, that is when the European countries and the U.S. openly, quite openly, on the streets of Kiev to crowds cheering for the overthrow of the government, they actively participated in that. If that's not meddling, I don't know what
is. The German foreign minister, the chairman of Lithuanian parliament, the head of the European diplomacy, Catherine Ashton, they were cheering, they were supporting the peaceful protesters who happened to kill 38 policemen. What is meddling if not this? And again, this phrase from Macron that everyone keeps misquoting. Macron said that basically we should be wary of the policies of the United States that can threaten Europe's security. What are these policies? We remember how Trump won the election unexpectedly in 2016, and Trump won promising peace with Russia. What was the reaction from Europe? Oh, God. Not that.
Okay.
I
got to go to a heartbreak here. Hold on to that thought. Okay, we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
All right, let me go back to Glenn here. Let's finish up on Trump being insulted and Macron trying to be the new Sun King of Europe. Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, I just wanted to make the point that I don't think the European Union really believes that Russian tanks are going to roll into Poland. But my point is that if you base the existence on the EU based on the military threats, then the huge Russian neighbor is going to be a key focus. And as a comparison, I think it's worth looking at NATO in the early 90s, because when the Soviet Union collapsed, what happened to NATO? NATO itself said we need to either get out of area or out of business. Out of area essentially meant we need to start expanding, intervening. Otherwise, if you don't do this, we don't have a purpose anymore, and NATO will fall apart. My problem if the EU becomes dependent, reposition itself as a military power, this essentially will go down the same path. It will need an enemy in order to exist, and is Russia.
If Macron wants to express European sovereignty from the United States and other countries, may I suggest that he starts not with a military, but with political and intelligence independence from the United States? I mean, I certainly remember in the last couple of years revelations through WikiLeaks that the CIA had penetrated every single significant French political party, right? Not worried about Russian hackers. How about the CIA and French political parties? Or when Obama's intelligence was bugging Merkel's mobile phone, right? Where was the big reaction against that? You want to start expressing some sovereignty and independence? Try doing it with your intelligence and politically.
Basically recognized by the United States that they listened to tens of millions of phone conversations of the French and the Spanish. But the problem is, you know, when you are talking about Europe being dependent on the United States, you have to make it more clear which United States. Obama and Hillary, they are revered in the neoliberal, ultra-liberal circles in Europe, ruling circles in Europe. If only these people come back to power, Russia will have a united front against it.
Yeah, this will be all forgotten again.
Exactly. And there is a very widespread view in Russia that somehow the United States is bad and the united Europe may be good for Russia. Well, let me remind the Russians that there were two times in history when Europe united militarily, under Napoleon and under Hitler. Both times, the consequences for Russia were tragic.
Catastrophic. All right, let's switch gears here. I started out by the program saying, asking the question, is the idea of peace in Yemen antithetical? Glenn, I mean, there was a lot of rhetoric over the last few weeks, but now the demand that there'd be a cessation of some kind of all the hostilities in Yemen have gone on deaf ears. The punishment for Khashoggi is still to be revealed. And the United States has said, I don't think it's happened yet, that it will no longer refuel Saudi planes bombing Yemen. Was this all just PR and it's just business as usual, war in Yemen?
Yeah, I think it's mostly for signaling. Of course, with this murder in the consulate, a lot of the U.S. media discovered that there's a war in Yemen.
Wow, isn't that amazing?
Who would have
thought?
If
you've been watching this program, you'd know it all the time. Yeah, keep going.
No, but you're correct. It's often portrayed as a Saudi war against Yemen, but it's very much a U.S.-Saudi war against Yemen, because the United States, it provides the weapons, it does the training, it does
logistics,
refueling, logistics, it does the intelligence, and most importantly, it does the targeting as well. It gives the target. So the Saudis pretty much pulled the trigger, and that's the end of it. So I think this idea that the United States can't do more to rein back the Saudis is false. But that's because the U.S. has a stake in the outcome of this war as well. So I think this is mostly signaling, because Congress is pushing for it, and the media is pushing for it.
The most dreadful signal that has come out is that the Trump administration may designate the Houthi as terrorists. If that isn't mixed signals, Pompeo, the war must come to an end, and then
the State Department and the Defense Department may designate the victims in this war, the Houthi, as being terrorists. I mean,
I don't know what definition of terrorism they're talking to declare the Houthis terrorists and not Saudi Arabia, right? I mean, we had a quote from the Washington Post this week that U.S. military leaders continue to see Saudi Arabia as a key partner in the counterterrorism fight that has dominated the Pentagon operations since 2001. They must have missed those.
That is Orwellian.
According to the Podesta Clinton emails, U.S. intelligence says that Saudi Arabia and Qatar were funding and arming ISIS, Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and Boko Haram, right? So, I mean, who's on what side with the terrorism here? Now, this is just, this is absolutely, as Glenn said, this is just signaling. This is the minimum step they can take to try to draw a degree of public perception removed. They continue to provide arms, C4 ISR.
Let me go to David. Yeah. But is this all, as usual, about Iran? Saudi Arabia is absolutely necessary with America's pathological obsession with Iran.
Well, it's the neocon obsession with Iran. I don't think the United States itself as a country is interested in all of this mess. But let's look at the persons. Let's look at the peacemakers from the United States, which are supposed to stop all these cruel things from happening. There is a report from Reuters that CIA Director Gina Haspel heard the audio recordings of Khashoggi's death, you know, when she visited Istanbul. I can imagine her reaction. So what? After all the prisons that the CIA ran in Europe and other places, was she really impressed by what she heard? At least we didn't hear anything from her.
I'm for sure. The first thing that went in her mind was damage control. Yeah. That's what she was probably thinking
about. From Mike Pompeo, you know, you want him to save Yemen when he says about Iran. He said it this week. Iran's leadership has to make a decision whether they want their people to eat. End of quote.
Well, that's a step up from, you know, act like a normal country. I think that was the quote before.
I think this is wonderful from Pompeo, because he's actually admitting what U.S. motivations with sanctions on any countries have always been. Right. He speaks out the other side of his mouth of supporting the Iranian people against the mullahs. At the same time, he says that the Iranian leaders had better get in line with U.S. foreign policy if they want their people to eat. I mean, this is the same kind of thing we saw with North Korea when Rex Tillerson was saying that with the advent of ghost ships with North Korea, that we were starting to see the sanctions were starting to have an effect, which is because the North Koreans were sending fishing ships out without even enough fuel to get back home. They were so desperate to provide food, right? And we saw the same thing all the way back with Madeleine Albright in Iraq, when she said it was worth it, right? However real, you know, we can debate, you know, the numbers that were involved in the question. But she 500,000, half a million. She, as the question was phrased, she accepted the premise and said it was worth it to starve half a million children.
Glenn, for me is that, and maybe it won't make a difference because the news cycle is so short and the attention span of people is so short. But I mean, for the first time during this horrific war, it actually got some coverage. I mean, even in the mainstream media here, with this more public awareness here, and I know that there are members of Congress, I don't know how high on the list after the midterms, but I mean, Yemen is part of the conversation now like it has never been before.
Yeah, but that also implies there's a need to start to shape the narrative. But I do agree, like in Congress, there's a push for doing much more than scaling back support with much more than simply the refueling. But we see that the narrative is shifting as well. That's why, you know, this week the Saudis, they started saying, you know, we stand with the people of Yemen because, well, I'm not sure how that works, but anyways,
I saw that. I didn't know how it worked either. I think I said something rather snide on Facebook about
it. And the United States are, you know, pushing the idea that the Houthis are now that they're a terrorist group, and of course they're saying, oh, we're pushing for a ceasefire. So I think because, you know, tens of thousands of people have been killed, the UN warned that millions of children are in risk of starvation. So if you're going to this huge humanitarian catastrophe, I think it's time to and the media is focusing on it now. I think there's They really need to start to control the narrative.
It might have some kind of momentum. All right, I mentioned three topics in my introduction. I want to get to the third one now. Russiagate, where have you been? Welcome back here, Mark. Now we're going to have a shift in Congress where the gavels will go into the GOP's hand and investigations in the DOJ and the FBI will probably go away.
Certainly with the House control, what were nascent investigations that, as far as I'm concerned, Paul Ryan never put enough force behind, as a counter reaction to, the political nature of the witch hunt, with the Mueller investigation. Going after Manafort's back taxes, really? I mean, that's what you come up with? It's just silly. But now, the Democrats will launch. You will see a flood of subpoenas. They will put as many Republicans and figures in the Trump administration as possible under oath, asking them provocative questions, just hoping they say something stupid and lie, right? However inconsequentially, about something that has nothing to do with actual Russiagate collusion or anything like that, they'll go into their own personal histories and taxes and everything like this, because this is all about, the House version of muckraking. So subpoenas, hearings, investigations into Trump's sexual peccadilloes, right, however far in the past, into his taxes, into giving Jared Kushner a security clearance and a position, right? The Mueller investigation was small fry. The blood sport's about to begin.
If you look at public opinion polls before the midterms, Russiagate doesn't rate as being very important with the public. It is with the Democrats, of course, and with the liberal media. It didn't pay them any dividends, I think, in the election, but they're still going to do it.
No, you're correct. They are going to push it. But part of the reason is the Democrats, they haven't really come up with a clear political message in terms of what's wrong with the country and how do we move forward.
So instead
Well, they say that Trump is narcissistic and only talk about himself. But the Democrats, they do the same. They only talk about Trump. So
really good
point. After they took the House, what was the first message that came out? Oh, we should get Trump's taxes.
Kavanaugh.
We should impeach Kavanaugh. We should impeach Trump. Like, all of this is fancy because it won't go through the Republican-controlled Senate. But nonetheless, if you can
It goes by so fast, gentlemen. We've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.